free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
There will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It's Wednesday, July 9th, 2014. Got an unusual show for you today. Today I'm sharing with you an interview that I did with C-SPAN a couple years ago at Freedom Fest in Las Vegas, which is taking place right now in 2014. I'm not there this year. But I was there in 2012, and I was there one or two times before that. And C-SPAN's Book TV sat down to talk to me about my book Rollback, which is really a book about everything. It's a book about all the arguments that you hear for the state and all the programs that we supposedly couldn't live without. And I beg to differ on that. So it's a good discussion. It's an interesting discussion because, as you'll see, the guy lets me talk. It's a incredible new innovation in journalism. The guest can speak. So it's a very good little chat. And of course, it's also interesting to hear how somebody might try to talk about our ideas when you've got only 20 minutes and you're talking to a general public that knows nothing about what we believe in. How do you do that? It's a tricky thing to navigate. C-SPAN's actually been very good to me over the years. They've pretty much covered every major title I've released. They've had some, there's been some event that they've covered for, as far as I can recall, all of them, I think. I don't know if there was one for 33 questions or not. But basically, they've done it all. Or sometimes multiple events for one book. So they've been very good, very friendly people. So I thought you might enjoy this interview. Before I turn to that, though, I did an event when I was in Boston in early June. And there was somebody recording the event with a camera right near where I was speaking. So I assumed that was the organization itself recording the event. But it turns out that person was not on their staff. And the talk has not been uploaded to YouTube. So I don't know who this guy is or where the recording is. But if that's you, please write to me. I know somebody did upload a multi-part version that was recorded on a cell phone. That's not really helpful to me. I would really like to get the recording from that camera. So if that's you, please drop me a line on the contact page at my personal site, tomwoods.com. I would really appreciate that. There's one particular sliver of that talk that I'd like to use. Okay, everybody, here I am on C-SPAN. Now, at the very beginning, there was some static, so I cut out the static. So the program is going to start very abruptly, but now you understand why. Hope you enjoy it.
C-SPAN 2, we are on location in Las Vegas at Freedom Fest, and we are joined now by author Tom Woods, who is the author. His most recent book is Rollback, Repealing Big Government Before the Coming Fiscal Collapse. Mr. Woods, how would you describe the premise behind your book, and what are your main points that you're trying to get across?
Well, only about 5% of the book deals with fiscal issues and the budget. I mean, I'd rather jump out a window than read or write a book on this. But to set the stage, I'm explaining that really we're on a trajectory that, you know, left or right or Democrat or Republican, whatever, we all have to admit just can't be sustained. Obviously, some very wrenching changes are coming. But then the rest of the book is sort of geared toward kind of revisiting some of the arguments by which we were sold big government. That, well, good heavens, if it weren't for this program, we'd have this problem. If it weren't for that one, we'd have that problem. What I'm trying to suggest is that when we, in fact, do have to cut back, it's not going to be the terrible catastrophe, the nightmare scenario. That, to the contrary, the silver lining of the crisis is that it will cut back on some of these things and will give their give a lot more scope for entrepreneurship and freedom.
Well, what are one of those budget items that you could see being cut back that could be advantageous?
Well, now here, with a book like this and with a publisher like mine, it's sort of assumed that I'm a right-winger and so I want to take the food stamps away from all the poor people and so on. Now, I am a libertarian. I do want to pretty much abolish everything. But to me, you take the low-hanging fruit first. And for me, the low-hanging fruit is the Pentagon. And, there was a time when I was a conservative and I thought, if you want to cut the Pentagon budget, you must be some kind of commie who hates America and all that. But when you look closely at this, you've got to understand, the Pentagon, the Department of Defense is the only department that is not subject to audit. Now, that doesn't mean that they failed the audit or, good heavens, look at all the things we found. They're not even subject to audit. And so what we've been finding, figuring out just piece by piece, is that, for example, since 9/11, in the 9 years after 9/11, the Pentagon budget went up. The increase in the Pentagon budget was about $2 trillion during those years. Now, $1 trillion went to the wars, but the other trillion, nobody quite knows where it went to, because the Air Force has been scaled back, the Navy has been scaled back, the Army increased marginally, but its budget was vastly increased. Where did the money go? And I think this is a crisis that we're enduring that is going to have to require both liberals and conservatives to rethink some of their, to re-examine some of their sacred cows and say, we can't afford to say, this is off the table for cuts, that's off the table for cuts. Nothing is off the table, but particularly the waste that's gone on. But also, it's not just that they've thrown a lot of money out the window, it's the way they do it. Because there are two techniques that they use to sort of get the taxpayer spigot going. So we've got political engineering, whereby once a program gets going, a missile program, a weapons program, it doesn't matter if the enemy that it was made for no longer exists. It doesn't matter that the thing can't really work as promised. The point, what you try to do is you get the project spread out among as many congressional districts as you can, particularly with congressmen who happen to sit on appropriations committees. And so the profits and the jobs get spread around everywhere. You can't ever stop it. And then there's also, the other technique is to vastly overpromise what it can do and underpromise what the cost will be. So you combine all these techniques and you get an extremely unresponsive system. And meanwhile, you get conservatives who say, I don't believe anything the government says and we got to cut things back. But when it comes to the Pentagon, everything they say is like holy scripture. Well, this is just a recipe for bankruptcy.
What is the myth of good government? The title of one of your chapters?
Well, yeah, this is going to strike right at the heart of our civics textbook platitudes, which is that government is there to provide indispensable services that we couldn't do without, we couldn't provide for ourselves, and government is composed of, by and large, public-minded servants who are just out looking out for the common good. And I'm suggesting that this is really more or less a fairy tale, that what more accurately describes what we have is a series of fiefdoms, where people are seeking to increase or at very least maintain their own power bases and increase their budgets and their authority. And that they begin, now maybe they're not, maybe they are thinking in a way that's public spirit. Maybe they've so come to associate their department with the public good, they can't think any other way, that anything that increases the scope of my department is an improvement. But they're all thinking at the end of the year, we've got to spend every last dollar that was appropriated, or otherwise next year they'll say, well, I guess you didn't need all that money. So you've got to blow that money on whatever you can. This mentality is everywhere. It is systemic.
Without government science funding, everyone would be an idiot.
Yeah, okay, that's one of my lines, right. And I believe this for a long time, because for a long time I was a free market guy, but I would say there are exceptions, right? I mean, let's not be extremists here. It's okay to have a free market in shoes, but there are some things that the market can't provide. And I would have thought, obviously science is one of those, because you can't necessarily earn a profit on basic science. It doesn't turn an immediate profit. You can't always capture the profits from science because your competitor will just grab your discovery and earn all the profits. So therefore, there'll be less science undertaken. This is sort of the typical neoclassical model of how science is going to work in the free market. It's just not going to work. So I believe that, but it turns out that this is not the case at all. And secondly, the old model that we sort of imbibed from Francis Bacon centuries ago was the way science operates is you gather some data, You examine it, you draw some hypotheses, and then you come up with some experiments. And the experiment either confirms or does not confirm, or provisionally confirms or does not confirm your hypothesis. And that's the way science operates. You start with basic examination, then you... And again, that sounds very plausible. But it turns out none of this actually describes how science has actually worked. In practice, the way it's worked is not that our discoveries are coming from people arbitrarily working in a laboratory and, oh my goodness, I discovered the steam engine. The steam engine develops out of people looking at current technology, practical people, and thinking, I need to adapt this to my needs. And then they solve their problems sort of on the spot. When the Department of Defense did a study not too long ago, and they said, how many of our great research breakthroughs came as a result of basic science, just starting from scratch in the laboratory? They looked at 700 projects. Two of them came from basic science. What science comes from is applied science. And so it turns out that there has been far more funding of science as a percentage of GDP by the private sector, by research foundations, by bequests, by amateur science, in the age before we had income and estate taxes. Governments have actually been far less generous toward the sciences than the voluntary sector of society was. Now, this is exactly the opposite of what we would think. But so often, we just casually assume that things have to be the way they've always been. And what I'm trying to do is do what Bertrand Russell recommended, is once in a while, you got to hang a question mark on things that you've come to believe for a long time.
Thomas Woods, what's the difference in your mind between a conservative and a libertarian?
Well, this is a tricky one. This is really, my heart is very much on the table here because I feel like I have sympathies in both camps. But I identify myself as a libertarian. The libertarian has one basic principle, which is non-aggression. You cannot initiate force against anybody else. Now, I think a lot of people would agree with that instinctively, that, of course, we know it's wrong to just go and clock your neighbor over the head. But libertarians would take that to the logical consequence, which is that you look at the things government does, they typically involve the initiation of violence against people who themselves have not initiated violence, so we would consider it to be illegitimate. A conservative is less, I guess, ideological. A conservative is deliberately, or at least in the classical sense, like Edmund Burke, an Edmund Burke conservative, is deliberately non-systematic. And I say that not as an insult, because they have good reasons for being non-systematic. Their view would be that life is too complex to be reducible to the one libertarian principle, or to be reducible to left liberal nostrums that we then impose on the whole world. Life is much too variegated for this, and we have to use experience, we have to use our knowledge of the past, and then move cautiously. So they would view, so you see, I speak with some sympathy of this point of view. So they would view the libertarian as just a hopeless ideologue who wants to force the whole world to conform to his one principle. But I guess my sympathy for the libertarian position is that at least I can pin it down to that one principle. Whereas sometimes trying to identify who's a real conservative, what's the real conservative position, it's like nailing jelly to a wall.
You write that federal bankruptcy, in short, may turn out to be one of the best things that ever happened to America.
Yeah, I got in trouble for saying that. I think Media Matters pounced on that one. How dare this guy say that? Well, when I say that federal bankruptcy may be a good thing, let's think in the sense in which any bankruptcy is a good thing. Now, the owners of a bankrupt firm are not happy about the bankruptcy. But the idea of bankruptcy is that you take a failing firm and you retool it, you sell off the assets, and then you see what good may come of it. And so sometimes bankruptcy is the best thing that ever happened to a firm. Well, in this case, I'm saying it's the best thing that ever happened to American society in the sense that right now we have got interests that are so entrenched that nothing, it doesn't matter which candidate you vote for, establishment candidate A or establishment candidate B, you're still going to get the same programs by and large. You're going to get very, very marginal tinkering around the edges. You'll never get these programs out of there until the checks start bouncing. That's the only way. Like, I used to be a college professor, and I was talking about the Job Corps, which is this relatively small budget program from the 1960s that persists to this day. And the idea is to give people job training, and then they go back into the market and they find jobs. But the fruits of it have been abysmal. Like most people who go through the, about a third of the people don't even show up for the program. And then of the ones who do, most of them never find work in their field, or they wind up at a barely over minimum wage job. And the program costs about as much as it costs to put a guy through Harvard for a year. So you would think that clearly this is a failure, right? If this were a private sector program, we'd be laughing at it. We'd be laughing at how corrupt the capitalist people are. But if it's a government program, we say, well, it must just be that they haven't spent enough money on it or whatever. And so when I would say this to my students, I had one student who said, well, if the program fails, why does it persist? And I thought that was a wonderful, beautiful, naive question. Why does it persist? Well, it persists because congressmen around the country will say this is a feather in their cap. Look, I voted for the Job Corps. And that helped to bring a lot of helpful programs here to our state. But what nobody ever asks is, how many people who went through those programs got employed in that field? Like in Alabama, where I lived for a number of years, I have a friend, an economist, who did a study of all the job training programs. And how many of them actually trained somebody for a job he actually got in that state that year? And the answer was one person. One person came through these programs. So obviously there have got to be better ways of doing this. But we're never going to crack through. There is so much entrenched bureaucracy around the Job Corps. You're never going to chisel your way through. I mean, you and I might say, well, it's a shame that $1 out of my tax dollars every year goes to this. Who's going to waste his breath over that? But if you are in that bureaucracy, it's a whole lot more than $1. You are getting a lot of concentrated benefits. You are going to fight tooth and nail to keep those programs in. So that's why a clean slate seems to be what we need.
We are at Freedom Fest in Las Vegas. This is Book TV on C-SPAN 2. We are talking with author Thomas Woods about his most recent book, Rollback, Repealing Big Government Before the Coming Fiscal Collapse. Where does the Fed fit into Rollback?
Yeah, good question. Well, the Fed is sort of another one of these topics that, again, we're sort of taught not to really think about, not to subject it to critical scrutiny. It's one of these things that's just there for the common good. And if you have a question about the Federal Reserve, you're probably a crank. You might need some kind of psychological evaluation. But because of the most recent financial crisis, it's harder to make that type of argument. More people who clearly are sane are asking questions about the Federal Reserve. What is this thing? What does it do? And so what I'm suggesting here is that the Fed is actually not the institution that, when we spontaneously have these business cycles that have no explanation, the Fed comes to the rescue and solves the problem. I'm suggesting that the Fed typically intensifies the problem, and that what we need to do is roll back the Fed as well. That the conventional wisdom surrounding the Fed is dead wrong. And in fact, and this is going to sound, I know I'm not supposed to say this, but when you look at how many economists, frankly, are in one way or another, directly or indirectly, on the Fed's payroll, it's like a giant cartel where everybody knows you don't speak ill of this institution. You want to get that research grant? You shut your mouth. Now, most economists don't even think consciously this way. They don't have to. Nobody's going to bite the hand that feeds them. But the Fed has been Fed was responsible for this most recent financial crisis. I mean, this was a time when Alan Greenspan is pushing interest rates to these super low levels and then telling people the fundamentals of the housing market are sound. You should go take out adjustable rate mortgages, interest-only mortgages. Everything is going to be fine. Lending standards are robust, Ben Bernanke said. Absolutely went right over their heads. Whereas meanwhile, the free market, which is blamed for the financial crisis, the free market was trying to say to people, stop doing this. Don't buy five houses as investments that you're not living in, and you have no job, and you have no documentation. Don't do this. The free economy was trying to put red lights on this in 2001. Red lights. Stop it. Stop. Stop. But when you're Alan Greenspan, when you're the Fed chairman, all you have is a hammer, which is lowering interest rates. Everything looks like a nail. We need lower interest rates. So we got 11 rate cuts in 2001. And so instead of red lights saying to people, stop speculating in real estate, letting interest rates go up to tell people, do something else. Don't think you're going to get rich just sitting in your house. Let interest rates go up. He wouldn't do that. He kept pushing them down. And so instead of the lights being red, everything was green. This is a problem caused by the Fed. So it's about time we talk about it.
Thomas Woods, what of your other books, what are some of the other topics that you've written about?
Well, a few years ago I had Meltdown, which was a New York Times bestseller. I talked about exactly what had caused the financial crisis because I knew I had pretty much the first book on the financial crisis that included the bailouts. because Regnery said, if you're going to get a book out on this, you've got to understand the whole world is going to have a book on this. You better hurry up. So I just worked like an insane lunatic on this book just to give the public something other than the Paul Krugman explanation of what happened. I talked about, again, the Federal Reserve. I talked about this this topic that's getting a lot of coverage these days, the Austrian School of Economics. What is this? Why did their economists know that there was a financial crisis coming? Did they, were they using a Ouija board? Did they have a crystal ball? How did they know? So that's what Meltdown was about. I've written a lot about U.S. history. So the first time C-SPAN covered me was The Politically Incorrect Guide to American History, which is just one of these books. The title sells it. Politically Incorrect Guide to American History. What's that? And my favorite C-SPAN memory was I was at a Barnes & Noble, and I was there to do a book signing. And my publisher, I won't mention, forgot to tell me C-SPAN was coming. So I thought I'm going to go there, sign a few books, and go home. I get there, and the manager of the store says, well, C-SPAN's setting up over there. And I said, I'm sorry, what? Yeah, C-SPAN was setting up over there. So I had to spontaneously come up with an hour's talk on the spot, and it went great. I mean, I came to the conclusion that from now on I should not script any of my talks. It actually was a turning point in my life, thanks to you guys.
What's your background?
Well, educationally, a bachelor's from Harvard, a PhD in Columbia in U.S. history, and I've taught, I've been a senior fellow at the Ludwig von Mises Institute, and now I pretty much run my own little educational thing called libertyclassroom.com, because now that we're living in this information revolution, it's a revolution that makes Gutenberg look like a lazy bum, like everybody can have his own blog and his own, so I teach U.S. history, basically, to anybody who's interested in learning about it through that site, so I keep busy.
And you live in Kansas?
I do live in Kansas, yes. That's, we have to have me on for another show about the backdrop to that, but yes, indeed.
And is it advantageous, in your view, to live outside of some of the major cities of the U.S.?
Well, it could be. I mean, obviously, there are pros and cons. We miss living near New York City. There are a lot of advantages to that. Obviously, if we ever really had a severe crisis, which I hope we don't, and we could avoid, certainly, I'm not sure that large population centers are where somebody would want to be. And then obviously, if the really unthinkable should happen, I mean, this is not why we moved, but if there were a really bad attack of one type or another, you know, well, we don't live in a concentrated area. There are advantages.
Well, we have been talking with Thomas Woods Jr. about his most recent book, published by Regnery, Rollback, Repealing Big Government Before the Coming Fiscal Collapse. This is Book TV on C-SPAN 2 on location in Las Vegas.
All right, that's the C-SPAN interview. I'm going to be finishing up my next book probably in the next 3 weeks. It's incredible how quickly this thing came together, but it should be done in the next 3 weeks or so, and then I have to send it out to be published and all that, and I don't know how long that's going to take. I'm going to self-publish this one, I think. I've never done that before, but I'm releasing the book not so much for big sales, although that'd be nice, but that's not my intent. I'm not going to be having a big publicity program for the book or touring around with it or anything, but I'm putting it together basically as a thank you to the listeners. I mean, the dedication page, it says, to my listeners at tomwoodsradio.com. So it really is a thank you to you guys, for people who have been listening to the show, telling people about the show. I mean, word of mouth is almost all I have. I do now, thanks to you guys who have been making your Amazon purchases through tomwoodsradio.com, I do have a budget to promote the show, which I've been using. And I do appreciate that, to help me get the word out. But I wanted to just be able to say thank you to people who support the show through the Supporting Listeners program at supportinglisteners.com. So you guys will be able to get that book as soon as it comes out. I'd like to release it to you guys, if I can get away with it, maybe 2 weeks before everybody else gets it. So if you're not a supporting listener yet, check that out at supportinglisteners.com. There will be goodies coming at you pretty consistently from now until I drop dead. The first major one will be this book, and then I'll do, it's going to be an e-book, so be prepared for that. But I'm planning to do the audiobook myself, and I'll also give you guys who are on the Supporting Listeners program, you guys will be able to get that. You won't have to pay any extra for that. That'll be just part of the Supporting Listeners program. So supportinglisteners.com, if you're enjoying the program, it's a mere 5 smackers a month. For as little as 5 smackers a month, you get all kinds of goodies, and then there'll be more and more and more goodies coming. My homeschool courses continue over at ronpaulhomeschool.com. Two of them that I have taught over this past year are going to be available a la carte within the next few weeks as well. And those of you who are at the higher levels in the Supporting Listeners program, you'll be getting those at no extra cost to you. So it's all kinds of fun stuff going on there. All right, that's it for today. Tell your friends about the show, TomWoodsRadio.com. We'll see you tomorrow.
The Tom Woods Show.